Bitcoin fixes this is a common refrain among Bitcoiners who have settled around the idea that changing our broken money system and replacing it with something better will allow us to finally address sweeping problems in our world today, from society and culture to politics and government. While that may be true, our guest today holds the belief that what is also required to take advantage of this new technology and emerging financial system is a new set of ethics that are born out of the classical virtues we've seen in successful, long-standing cultures like feudal Japan. Alex Fetsky is an entrepreneur and author of the best-selling Uncommunist Manifesto and the newly released Bushido of Bitcoin. And the conversation today is a deep dive into Alex's position around the importance of virtues that have been seen in warrior cultures throughout history, in particular, samurai culture from ancient Japan. I'm Scott Deedles. I'm the CEO and founder of Block Rewards, and part of our mission in bringing Bitcoin to the workplace is helping people understand how it will help them. Today's conversation is a dive into the importance of rethinking our approach to how to be in society alongside a changing monetary system. So if you're interested to learn something about samurai culture and the Bushido Code of Ethics and how it relates to incorporating Bitcoin successfully into the world of tomorrow, then stick around. This one is quite a ride. All right, welcome to another episode of the Block Reward Podcast, joined by our guest this week, Alex Svetsky. Alex, welcome to the show.
Scott, thank you for having me.
We're going to be talking today about your new book, The Bushido of Bitcoin. I'm very excited to get into that, but maybe just as we get started, for our listeners who might be new to you, could you give us a little 2-minute rundown on your background and how you came to be writing the book?
Yeah, let's do it. So I have more of an entrepreneurial background, despite more people knowing me for my writing. I think I've written a couple million words on Bitcoin for Bitcoin Magazine, for my own, essays and my own Medium. I had a Substack, that I was pushing for a little while, all that sort of stuff. So I've done quite a bit of writing, but my journey into Bitcoin came through an entrepreneurial angle. So I built the world's first Bitcoin-only dollar-cost averaging app, a product called Amber out of Australia. And, we fundamentally, I believe, inspired the whole Bitcoin as a savings instrument movement. So after us came Swan and River, and I guess you guys have ShakePay in Canada. I'm assuming you're in Canada, right?
Yeah.
Et cetera. So yeah, that was sort of, definitely an entrepreneurial journey into Bitcoin that along the way I just started writing, because as you know, Bitcoin sort of sucks you in many ways. It's extremely stimulating intellectually, philosophically, and all this sort of stuff. So I was just inspired to write about it, to sort of ask the deeper questions. And that led me to produce a book called The Uncommunist Manifesto with Mark Moss a couple of years ago. And that hit the bestseller list. That got us on some pretty interesting podcasts like Robert Kiyosaki and Alex Jones and all that sort of stuff, which was hilarious. And yeah, last year I founded a company that just recently open sourced the world's first Bitcoin centric language model. So anybody can use that. We open sourced it. It's free. Anyone can download it and run it on their own machine if they want. Or if they want to pay some sats, they can go to spiritofsatoshi.ai. So it's similar to ChatGPT, except it's what I would call based, right? So if you ask it about Bitcoin, it's not going to tell you to diversify your portfolio and all that kind of crap. So that, a lot of work went into that. We open sourced it. Couldn't figure out how to make money out of it, honestly. The AI space is a big, it's a big VC racket, really. It's a, VC laundromat. They just raise money from the LPs. They flush it down to the startups, and the startups spend all the money on training their models with NVIDIA and Google, right? So it's like this mad laundry. So we've kind of pivoted the business into more of an applied AI instead of an AI company. And I think we've stumbled onto something really interesting at the nexus of Bitcoin, Nostr, travel, and sort of AI stuff. So, we've been working on, on that for a number of months. But yeah, alongside that, also, I've got this goddamn book, Bushido of Bitcoin, that I've been writing for 2 years. So got my fingers in many pies, sorry. A lot of things going on. So we can talk about any of that.
Yeah, lots of interesting things to threads to pull on there. I am fascinated by you know, the book is really a larger discussion about sort of morality and ethics and the culture of Bitcoin. And I wonder if we, before we go there, you mentioned, you know, being early into understanding Bitcoin as a savings tool and building this dollar cost averaging tool. How did you and how do you conceptualize what Bitcoin is?
Yeah, I mean, I don't see it as an investment. I see it as money. And the best way I can describe it is through a narrative. And many, many years ago, I wrote this sort of like basic guide to understanding Bitcoin. And it was really simple. We never published it or anything like that. We just gave it to our Amber users at the time. But the story or the narrative that I used is I said, imagine if you could go back 5,000 years and let's say the society you lived in at the time was still trading using shells or rocks and stuff like that. Maybe we need to go back 10,000 years, whatever, right? And imagine if you stumbled on this yellow, shiny rock on the ground and you're like, this is cool. And somehow you knew that it was fungible, portable, recognizable, scarce, you know, had all these attributes. And, you know, you went to a shop to buy like some food, you know, a chicken or something like that. And, you know, the guy would look at you and be like, the hell's this yellow shiny rock? We only accept shells here. What's wrong with you? And you'd be like, but look, you know, this yellow shiny rock, it's the future of money. Like everyone in the world is going to end up on this money. And, you know, everyone would have laughed at you. They'd be like, this moron, you know? And if you could somehow live a couple thousand years and you just collected this yellow shiny rock, at some point when the rest of the world caught up and realized that the properties of this yellow shiny rock, which is obviously gold, when everybody converged on that reality and realized that, hey, this thing is scarce. It's, you know, homogeneous. It's inert. So it doesn't, you know, react with other chemicals. It is recognizable. It's portable. It's got all these beautiful attributes that make it ideal for representing this concept of money, which is a language of value. You know, at that point, a couple thousand years later, you would have been able to buy an entire country or, you know, an entire kingdom or whatever, right? So that's where we are with Bitcoin, except that 5,000 years or 10,000 years is going to be compressed to probably 100 years. So right now, we are collecting Bitcoin. That's it. And for me, I view it as somewhere between a collectible and a proto-money, somewhere on that sort of level. It has all of the It has all the functions of money and it can perform all of the functions of money perfectly. Like it is a perfect medium exchange. I can send it to you right now. Nobody on the planet can stop me. It is a perfect store of value in the correct definition of the concept, which is I know my proportion in relation to the whole. If I hold one Bitcoin, I will always and forever hold 121 millionth of the entire network. Store of value has nothing to do with price. Store of value has to do with proportion. A lot of people get this wrong. And finally, it's a unit of account, which also has to do with proportion and knowing the total sum. Bitcoin's the only thing we know of that has a fixed limit, a predetermined limit, right? So it performs the functions of money already, and it has all of the attributes of money. We just need to catch up. It needs to take a couple of generations, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 generations or whatever for the actual usage of Bitcoin to catch up with its capacity or its ability. And that's what I think is, you know, really fundamentally special about Bitcoin. It's built not for now, it's built for 100 years from now. And that fact allows us to collect it now at an extremely large discount. Like, you know, the best meme I know of in the Bitcoin space is everything there is and everything there ever will be divided by 21 million, which is obviously by Knut Svanholm. That's the idea that money measures everything. You know, the microphone that you're speaking through, the one that I'm speaking through, your painting on the back wall, your headphones, your house, your car, the cafe that you eat at, the real estate, all the stocks, everything in the world is measured against money. And every money at the moment is just a proxy for the US dollar, really. As Bitcoin eats away at that, and as multiple generations filter through, we will come to a point in time where Bitcoin measures everything. And if you divide that by 21 million, you'll realize that the purchasing power of a single Bitcoin is going to be astro-fucking-nomical. And, you know, that's sort of how I see it. So anyway, I hope that makes sense. We can pull on any of those threads.
Yes, beautifully said. I love the way of looking at it as money as a language of value. And I think that this is part of the, you know, these relate to some of your ideas. The idea that we use the money that we use every day, regardless of where we live, we're using that language right now. And those monies make less sense than Bitcoin does. And the output of that is a lot of things in our society that don't make sense. And I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about, you know, predating writing the book. Obviously, you're studying and observing cultural trends that tie to broken money. What is, in your opinion, like the effect of fiat money on culture and society.
I did actually explore that in the book. Maybe later in the book, I try and challenge that concept. I actually think the culture breaks before the money. That's something I actually worked out here. You know, I think Bitcoiners actually have this really, really wrong. We all think that you fix the money, you fix the world. No. You fix virtues, you fix culture, then you fix the money, then you fix the world. Money is just an accelerant. It is downstream of politics and culture. We didn't just wake up one morning and decide to print money. The culture decayed upstream. And, you know, if I sort of point to the West at the moment, I'd say the initial decay came from the French Revolution when we inverted paternity, we inverted the natural order of things, and we started creating universal suffrage and all this sort of stupidity that came out of the French Revolution. And then we fucked it all up. 200 years later, we decided to print infinite money. But that didn't just happen overnight. Now, that being said, the money printing is almost like if we look at a cancer, right? A cancer generally is the time at which we notice that the disease is there. So when the money print turns on, it's like the cancer becomes malignant and things accelerate. The decay of civilization accelerates. But the actions beforehand, staying at home, you know, not training, eating fucking seed oils and whatever, like all of the bad habits and everything, that's the culture element. That's what happened beforehand. That's what leads you to the point of, oh shit, now I have cancer. Well, you know what? Now I have cancer. I'm going to die. So fucking YOLO. I'm just going to eat more seed oils. I'm just going to take more drugs. I'm going to party, right? That's the stage we're at in civilization. So that is, you know, late stage when the fiat really, really kicks in. And unfortunately, that sort of takes everything down with it, right? And that's the stage where we're at. And, you know, I used to fervently believe I was in the camp. And this is one of the, you know, going to be the controversial opinions in the book is that, you know, Bitcoin doesn't fix everything. It's actually fixing the virtues that we live by is the underlying thing. Bitcoin will help produce a check because, you know, and the way it produces a check is by putting an economic cost on time preference again. Right. So when you have fiat money, when you have money untethered to reality, you can cover up poor economic decisions with paper, basically, or with imaginary units. And that can lead you to making more and more poor decisions, right? Because you don't have a feedback mechanism. You don't know if I do X, the result is Y. Really, on a fiat standard, like, you know, the best example is like these ghost cities in China. They will build entire cities, their GDP will go up, then they'll blow up the cities and they'll rebuild them and they'll say, our GDP is still going up. They literally just burnt resources, but they can do that because they can just print some more money and paper over the losses, right? So that's how we're living as a society at the moment. So fiat absolutely like accelerates the decay to no end because it breaks the feedback mechanism that would tell you were otherwise doing something wrong. And Bitcoin offers a check against that, or it creates a cost to help like buffer that. But I don't think that it solves everything, but it's definitely intertwined, you know, like the culture and the money, like they're both in symbiosis. Like we also can't have a world where we somehow, you know, separate culture and money. That doesn't work either because, you know, money is, as I said earlier, is a language of value. We're always going to need a language of value. So these things are like, they're really intricate. Yeah, it's hard to disentangle because it's impossible to disentangle, but they are related, but we can't. And this is one of my big things in the book is that we can't just say Bitcoin fixes this and then, you know, expect that everything's going to be fine. Like there's a lot more that goes into it.
So you have a potential blueprint for the reimagination of values that can hopefully fix course correct society. And this is sort of the basis for the book. So maybe just talk a little bit about how you transition from that idea of first fixing the virtues to sort of samurai culture and maybe actually even just what is Bushido for people who are listening and don't know anything about it?
Yeah, so that's a good one. Let's start there. So Bushido means way of the warrior. Basically, it's like an unwritten code that the samurai came to live by over the centuries, basically, because they became the class that elevated itself into essentially lord and kingmaker, right? So as they came to hold the upper echelons of feudal society in Japan, they sought to establish a code of honor or a code of virtue that would guide their behavior, because, you know, I mean, we know it from Spider-Man, you know, with great power comes great responsibility, right? So it was sort of like the early genesis of that. And we had a we had a real corollary in the West with chivalry, right? So the closest, analog to Bushido is this concept of chivalry. So the reason I settled on that was, it was actually happenstance. Myself and Eric Kaysen were on a podcast a couple of years ago. He was on mine actually when I was still running Wake Up Podcast. And we talked about a book called Shogun by James Clavell. Fantastic book. If anyone's not read it, I highly, highly recommend either the read or the Audible is fantastic job. Like they did that incredibly. It's about 50 hours.
The TV series is excellent as well.
I have not watched the TV series yet, but I saw Hiroyuki Sanada was in it, so I assume it's going to be good. I heard that he pushed back against the wokeness.
Yeah, I don't watch a ton of TV, but I was blown away by how well it was produced.
Excellent. I'm sure, as usual, the books are better, but like I cannot wait to watch that. It's been on my list of things to do. I hate modern television, but it looks like one of the rare few exceptions. So that being said, that was sort of a conversation that Kaysen and I had at the time, and we called the podcast Bushido of Bitcoin. And from there, like it sparked an idea in me. I was like, I wonder if there's like a set of virtues that we can, extract from this Japanese Bushido, which, the general virtues are like justice, courage, honor, loyalty, compassion, respect, self-control, etc. So, it wasn't like a written code. It's not like the Ten Commandments in Christianity. It was just a code passed down by word of mouth from samurai to samurai, down the family line. And it was a thing that was known. And it was something that was looked for as, it's kind of, yeah, what's the word? I think you get what I mean, right? It wasn't a written code. It was a culture or a way of being that was, watchful. So anyway, the book started off as me trying to relate that directly to Bitcoin, but the book's evolved like, I'm on draft 7 and it's evolved far more since then. And really what ended up happening for me is I decided to look at more than just the Japanese culture. I decided to look at what were the greatest civilizations that ever existed on Earth. And because culture is upstream of civilization, I said, okay, what were the cultures that preceded the greatest civilizations on Earth? And because virtue is upstream of culture, I then asked, what were the virtues that these cultures embodied? And what I found was amongst the Romans, the ancient Greeks and Macedonians, the Arthurian or Germanic or Faustian West, right, the Japanese samurai, they all had a massive overlap in these virtues. And all of them were actually emergent from warrior cultures, basically. So I found this and I basically took what the best overlap was and I came up with what I'm calling the Bushido of Bitcoin, which is 10 virtues for a world on a Bitcoin standard. So I make the claim that, look, we live on the fiat standard now. The playbook on a fiat standard is, lie, cheat, steal, get into banking, get into politics, find a way to like fuck someone over, etc. Now, you can still be good on a fiat standard and you can still find some success, but you'll get more success, quote unquote, by, gaming the system. So my counter to that is, okay, if we live on a Bitcoin standard where cheating is much harder, theft is much harder, et cetera, what is the new playbook that we need to adopt to win on that standard? And that I put forth as the Bushido of Bitcoin, which is, okay, these are the virtues. You live by these, you will succeed on a sound money standard. So that's kind of the premise. And then, yeah, each virtue, I do a deep dive on the Japanese etymology of the word, the English, Latin, Proto-Indo-European roots of the word, the Greek roots of the word. And man, it's fascinating to see the overlap of meaning from cultures and languages that are unrelated. Like it was wild. Like I'm looking at this thing. I'm like, man, there's something more to words. There's something more to language than what we appreciate on the surface. And yeah, I go into all of that with each virtue. And then I look at historical examples and anecdotes, from the Alexander the Greats of the world, the Napoleon, the Leonidases, the Cyrus the Greats and all that sort of stuff of how they each embody these virtues. And, I try and use the book as inspiration. So that's the meat of the book. And then there's a bunch of other parts as well that ask a bunch of different questions. So anyway, I'll stop there. I'm kind of going off on tangents here.
Yeah, I think it's a recurring theme in the book, the importance of sort of leadership and greatness. And you mentioned Alexander the Great and some of these really, high-level historical people. In terms of this concept of culture and virtue sort of being passed top-down, can you talk a little bit about your concept of Maybe just talk a little bit about that subject a little bit. It's an interesting part of the book.
Yeah. So it seems to me, at least from all the evidence that I can find, that culture is actually more driven not by the ground up, not by the, you know, the peasant class or the slave classes or the lower classes. It seems to be driven most by the inspiring classes. And the inspiring class seems to be the warrior class, those who go out there and live at the edge of life and death. They're the ones that inspire both the kings. And in many cases, the greatest warriors became kings, right? And because of that, because they inspired everybody else and they gained populist power. Like that was Julius Caesar, right? He became that because he inspired the populace to get behind him because of his show of valor, competence, bravery, courage, etc., right? So to me, it looks like that is what inspires culture more than anything else. And cultures or civilizations that don't have a warrior class or don't hold them in high esteem seem to end up quite weak, pacifist. They get taken over, they get forgotten, and all this sort of stuff. So it's something that will honestly rub some Bitcoiners the wrong way. I think a lot of Bitcoin people are unfortunately brainwashed by, you know, communist doctrines, you know, the whole, we are all in this together, we're plebs and, you know, strength in numbers and all this sort of stuff, I think is more of a communist thing. Like you look at what the communists tried to do is they tried to establish a culture from the bottom up. Every single freaking time it failed, it was a complete disaster because they didn't focus on, like, you know, excellence and valor and virtue and all this sort of stuff. These are virtues exhibited or embodied by the few. And the goal is that they, like a few, reach to show what's possible. And that inspires everybody else to reach up. Whereas if the focus is on the average or, you know, the everyday man and all this sort of stuff, the pleb, people think it's okay to then just be average and to settle and to be less and to stop looking up and to sort of look level or look down. And that's sort of the world that we live in at the moment. Like you, and I mean, you see this on Bitcoin Twitter, you see it everywhere. And it's, you know, Twitter more broadly, and it's the world more broadly, is that people have like an envy and a resentment for beauty, for greatness, for excellence, for people who are trying to climb and build and create and do stuff. Like people have it's almost like a skepticism. They, you know, I experience this a lot in Australia, and it's a thing that's known there. They call it tall poppy syndrome. It's like a poppy is like a flower. If you come above the others, they want to cut you down to size straight away. And this is a big reason why Australia never succeeded. America had this spirit of like elevating the few greats, and America became great because of that. And all previous great civilizations became great because of that. They were able to glorify and admire, revere great men. That all got flipped upside down, you know, post-French Revolution moving forward, right? You know, with democracy and with, you know, equalitarianism, with communism and all this sort of other stupidities. Like we lost touch with that. And, you know, we have a world of acceptance and of, like, I don't know, of average. Like, you know, being an average man is an aspiration today. It's like, I don't know, I've personally find that pathetic. And I think Bitcoin will establish a framework that moves us back in the direction of excellence, in my opinion. So anyway, that's sort of like some unscripted thoughts on that. We can pull further on that thread if you like.
Yeah. And maybe just to make the connection for the listeners. So to go back to one of the things you said at the outset of the conversation is the deep, deep discount that we're buying or collecting Bitcoin at today based on where it could be valued in the future. And so sort of the parallel, I guess, argument in the book is that those who are able to successfully retain their Bitcoin over this time are going to be very wealthy people in the future. And so this is why it's important, because those people then have an opportunity to, you know, be the beacons of excellence or be, you know, creating culture in that sort of top-down way.
It's the opportunity and the obligation, right? Because they will. And this is really, really important. Is like people think power comes just without responsibility. And that's the biggest problem we have in the world today, is you've got people who have power and take no fucking responsibility. Like, so you look at the WEFs of the world, the politicians of the world, etc. They do whatever the fuck they want and somebody else pays the bill. That's why things are so corrupt and that's why things are so broken. This is why monarchy is so much better, is that the monarch, the king, the leader, traditionally held the responsibility for what they did. And they were killed if they fucked up. Whereas in a democracy, it's like, okay, yep, I come into power, I rape and pillage and bomb some countries and print a bunch of money and put the country in debt. And you know what? Look, my time in office is over. Sorry, you know, let the next guy fucking deal with it. Like, and we just literally like erode the hell out of everything that we built.
Yeah, I mean, and it's not even just that they walk away, like Jacinda Ardern. These people walk into sort of cushy other jobs in the private sector or whatever. And say, yeah,
they write a book and they make another couple $1 million. It's a total scam. It's an absolute scam. And that like, you know, once again, it rubs me the wrong way. You've got all these people that are like, oh, you know, the world was backwards in the age of feudalism and kings and everything were bad. It's like, well, no, that's actually not how it was. You know, the old nobility actually carried the responsibility, or they carried far greater responsibility. That's not to say that everyone was perfect in the past and, you know, there was no bad apples. Of course there was. There always is. Every single system is going to have bad apples. Every single system is, there will be bad kings and bad rulers and bad emperors and all this sort of stuff. But objectively speaking, a hierarchical structure that is excellence oriented, that has a clear leadership at the top, is going to be far superior than some sort of homogenous mass that is like a hydra that you can't point to. And the greatest modern example, honestly, is Bukele. Bukele is effectively a philosopher king. He is the leader of El Salvador. And with his leadership and foresight, he's literally transformed the country. Literally transformed the country. He's done what nobody could do in that entire Central American region for decades upon decades upon decades, probably centuries. He did it in 5 years. Fucking incredible. And that's sort of what I get at in the book, is like, Bitcoiners will have the opportunity and obligation to be people with that sort of that kind of resource to do that sort of thing. And the time is now to begin developing, inculcating, and adopting these kind of virtues. And I pick the 10 virtues specifically because they almost act as tensions amongst each other. You know, you've got like justice in there, but you've also got compassion. So you can't be too overly just. You know, people make mistakes. So there needs to be like, justice needs to be tempered with compassion, for example, because you need to know that everybody in some way, shape, or form is flawed. So you need to have the space for them to heal, to get better, you know, to turn themselves around, etc. So anyway, I think these are just like, yeah, there's a lot in there to explore. I'll leave it there for the moment.
Yeah, maybe just to connect through then on this sort of thread of the conversation, like obviously it's a big book. So to give sort of an overview of how you imagine the collection of these virtues, crafting a sort of Bitcoin code of ethics. Like, can you maybe just summarize, or maybe pick a few of these virtues and maybe talk a little bit more about, you know, how it looks on the whole?
Yeah, I mean, let me pull up the book and let's read out all 10 in that case. Where the hell are I? Just want to make sure I have them right and in order. So we've got justice as the first virtue. And in fact, I'll just read out a little bit of it here. So justice is the first virtue. A reflection on what is fair and righteous for the purpose of upholding a moral character. Courage, the spirit of daring and bearing, the inner strength and valor to not just know what is righteous, but to act upon it. So courage requires the strength, to not only perceive, but also to act and bear the consequences. Benevolence or compassion, it's the affection for others. Passion, magnanimity, and affection for others were ever recognized to be the supreme virtues and the highest of all attributes of the human soul. Compassion is the ability to suffer with those you love and requires patience and humility to see the world from the perspective of another, right? So that's like a tempering effect on justice, courage. The Japanese focuses on politeness, but I focused more on respect, is the outward manifestation of a sympathetic regard for the feelings of others. So that's a quote pulled from a book called Bushido, the Soul of Japan, written in the 1900s. It implies a due regard for the fitness of things and pays respect to social positions and hierarchy. In other words, it's not just the regard and reverence for the experience and feelings of others, but also respect for tradition and custom. Then I've got honor. Honor implies a vivid consciousness of personal dignity and worth. The samurai lived by the highest code of conduct, and it was this honesty first and foremost with oneself that defined honor. Honor was known as the immortal part of oneself, that which lives on after your physical body has passed on. We know it as sort of reputation these days, right? Loyalty is the glue that binds relationships both of love and of respect. In feudal Japan, loyalty and duty to one's lord or compatriot were distinctive features. You keep your word and you perform your duty, even if it means you must give your life. And number 8, self-control. along with courage, this is the quintessential virtue of the warrior, the discipline of fortitude. Self-control in Bushido meant the discipline to adhere to this code under all circumstances, whether it's hard or easy, whether in the presence of others or alone. And then I added responsibility and excellence, basically. So responsibility, the obligation to bear the consequences of one's actions and fulfill one's duties. It's about owning your decisions and their impact on you, others, and society. And finally, excellence, the essence of virtue. It's the separation from average. It is the energy of vitality in life. Excellence is that which pushes boundaries and expands. Excellence establishes new standards and is the driving force behind progress and beauty. So that's an overview of the 10.
And so, yeah, I was struck by this. You know, you were talking earlier about the balance of, it's like a collection of having rigid beliefs and uncompromising conviction in your way of being, and also being very, you know, the Japanese, yeah, they have this innate sense of hierarchy and protocol and ritual. Like everything is very organized and conscious of others. One of the really interesting things I thought you dove into a little bit was the concept of getting back to greatness and of fear. And you ask the question, or you make a statement around how we may be too afraid to fully live life. I'd love to just pick your brain a little bit on that statement. And maybe, you know, you pull in a number of other different thinkers outside of the classical Japan to give context to these ideas. So a lot of Nietzsche, a lot of, you know, some Ayn Rand. What does it mean for you to, you know, kind of embrace this collection of virtues? And, you know, that's a big, broad, open-ended question, but
yeah, let's try hit the thing, what you said about like this fear of greatness, for example. I think a lot of people are more afraid, not of even like losing or failing, but I think they're more afraid of what it means to succeed and be in the limelight. They're more afraid of potentially winning. And, you know, people call it imposter syndrome, this and that. You know, we all have it. We all experience it to some degree. Some people face that fear. And this is the importance of the virtue of courage, for example, is, you know, courage isn't the absence of fear. Courage is the feeling of fear and the fortitude to face it anyway, right? But unfortunately, many others, they will cope by trying to, and this is what we said before about the tall poppy syndrome, they'll cope and they'll try and just bring others down. They'll be like, oh, influencers are losers, or, you know, everyone's a scammer, or whatever the fuck else they sort of pull out of their asses these days about like trying to bring down basically the man in the arena. And it reminds me of that Teddy Roosevelt quote, right? It's like the man in the arena is the one out there fighting and he's on display. And, you know, you've got these weirdos and dorks basically who are no different to Jerry Springer audience members, right? Like they're just out there pointing and laughing and flexing their comment muscles on Twitter. They're not actually doing anything. And, you know, they will cope by scorning the great, the beautiful, the excellent, and the person who actually goes out there and tries. And I have far more respect for anyone who, I have the most respect for the person who goes out, who tries and succeeds, because it takes a special kind of character to push through and succeed. Even more than him, the person who goes out, tries, fails, gets up again, fails, gets up again, fails, gets up again, and succeeds. That's the person who I have probably the most respect for. Then the person who goes in, tries, and succeeds straight away, because that is still very noble. The person I have a lot of respect for the person who gets in the fucking arena and fails and may never succeed. He still was more brave than the loser in the audience who never did any of it, who just flexed his comment muscles, right? And we have way more of those people. And they're people who are fundamentally not only afraid of failing, but they're afraid of succeeding. So they won't do either. They will spend their lives on Twitter or Reddit or fucking Nosta these days, wherever they are, and they'll just laugh at people, they'll make memes, they'll tease, they'll do whatever in a bid to, I don't know, cope with their own emptiness or own lack of courage or whatever it is, right? So I don't explain it like that in the book, but I don't know, I just get this sense that there's this unfortunate, call it envy or resentment of people and things that attempt to produce something, you know, great or beautiful that, you know, the world has unfortunately become allergic to. I think that's going to change. I think that's going to change in the coming century. It's going to take a while for it to change, but we will come to a time again where nobility is something that we look up to and that we admire and respect, like they did in the Vedic Samurai.
This leads nicely into a quote that I'm just going to read, if that's okay with you. It says, "The broader social result is nihilism, because deep down, nobody really wants to play an unfair game. Those who are disadvantaged give up, and those who are cunning or advantaged enough to compete simply lose themselves in the process and become soul-selling humans." There's another, you know, subject that you touch on throughout the book is kind of this, I want to say fiat nihilism, is like the idea that you're talking about this. You know, it's very connected to the concept of greatness, where I wonder how people relate to their intrinsic sense of whether or not they think they can actually success in the current roles of the game is even possible, and what that means for some of these other social phenomena that you're talking about.
Yeah, that's definitely interlinked, right? So you've got, I mean, look, there's always bright spots, right? There are people, despite everything being against us in the world, despite the playbook incentivizing cheaters to win and paying them more and all this sort of stuff, there is still a few people who will get in there, they'll get in the ring, they'll know that the odds are stacked against them, and they'll still do the right thing. And in many ways, I've actually got a lot of respect for Bitcoiners in this sense, is that a lot of them, you know, people like Francis Pouliot, for example, in Bull Bitcoin, I know for a fact that he has been offered a lot of money in the past to make Bull Bitcoin a shitcoin casino. And he has left significant money on the table and remained Bitcoin only, right? So there is bright spots like that. But look where Francis is, look where Brian Armstrong is in terms of material wealth. You get me? So there is a cost to maintaining that moral integrity. Most people see that and they're like, fuck it, I'm an entrepreneur, I'll just be like Brian Armstrong and I'll go roll my shitcoin and I'll make a bunch of money and fuck it, who cares? Like they know that what they're doing is wrong, but they're like, look, fuck it, I want to make $1 billion, right? So that's what I'm talking about, like the cunning entrepreneurial type. Like he will just sell his soul and do it. And then there's others who don't have the fortitude of a Francis and don't have the cunning of a Brian Armstrong. And they're just like, oh, fuck this shit, I'm just going to give up. And then they give up and they go into nihilism. And, you know, many of them just become shitposters, basically, right? And unfortunately, a lot of their shitposting, while accurate in its depiction, doesn't actually help. You know, it just creates an environment where, you know, we devolve into immaturity, right? And, you know, I used to be a shitposter and I still shitpost to some degree, but I don't know. I think it's just a sign of having given up, right? I think there's more that people can do with their time and energy.
You mentioned that, you know, the book it continues to evolve as you're still working on it, but it's changed dramatically from the original idea, which I think is very common for authors. What's something along the way, an insight that you gleaned that was unexpected, or an evolution of the book, a direction it went that surprised you, or, you know, taught you something that you didn't know when you set out to do it?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is what we mentioned before about, like, does fixing the money fix the world, right? And that was, for me, like, one of the big takeaways. It's like, well, wait a minute. No, the decay, the cancer started upstream. And I'm convinced Bitcoiners are just wrong on this one. And maybe wrong is probably too strong a word. They're missing the nuance that culture is just important and it's intertwined with fixing the money. You can't just fix the money and magically the world gets fixed. So I think that was a big one for me, because I've been one of the classic people, just, you know, on there on Twitter, I built an entire reputation around fix the money, fix the world. If you fix the money, if everyone just adopted Bitcoin, everything would change. And there is some truth in that, but the truth is gray in that context. There is a lot more that goes into fixing the culture. Like, if we just get Bitcoin and we just still operate like people with no courage, no virtue, no honor, and all this sort of stuff, like, we'll just be maybe wealthier losers, basically. Like, so there's something else that has to come with it. And that was one of the big takeaways for me, is I didn't set out to write that in the beginning. That's something I discovered as I deep dove.
You know, I think that as well, having read the book, there's definitely a consistency in the message, you know, because as you acknowledged earlier in the conversation, aspects of what you have to say, you know, that it may not be something that everyone wants to hear, but how you say it is entirely consistent with you know, the ideas that you've pulled forward from thinkers and success stories in history. So, you know, I want to congratulate you for what I thought was an excellent read. I ended up enjoying it even more than I expected. And I'm a history guy myself. Like, and I just had happened finishing watching the Shogun series. So it was cool to be able to dive into Japanese culture again in a more deep way.
Perfect timing. Man, I highly recommend get yourself the Shogun on Audible as well. Like, the few people that I've spoken to about the series, they said that it was fantastic, but there was a lot omitted, obviously, just to make the series make sense. It's a massive book, yeah. But like I said, the Audible is fantastic. You just put it on, the voice actor is incredible. He does such a good job. And yeah, you just like go on a journey. It's fantastic.
Any other sort of final thoughts, like wrapping up? Book's coming out. It may be out by the time, I'm not sure what your release schedule is, or anything else that you want to say before we wrap up?
I mean, look, if people are interested in this, they can pre-order it on bushidoofbitcoin.com. So I managed to get myself the .com, and there's a link there. They can get a free chapter. Or they can go to the link and they'll see the Geyser crowdfund and they can pre-order it. It's about half the price that it'll be on Amazon when it goes out. So if they want to, you know, save a little bit of money, they can do that. Other than that, I mean, yeah, if I encourage people to, you know, a lot of people get triggered by some of the things I say, but I encourage them to do their best to think a little bit deeper, dig a little bit deeper. There's a lot of nuance here, and you know, it's very easy to just jump on the next trend and the next bandwagon. Like, I mean, one that I was teasing people for on Twitter the other day was the whole carnivore and meat steak only stuff. Yeah, the pizza thing, exactly. I was like, man, get the fuck out of here. Like, you know, let's all just be honest with ourselves. Pizza tastes fucking amazing, and don't give me your moral high ground of like, oh, steak only. It's like, shut the fuck up. Like, you know, these people, like, they remind me of the NPCs that they make fun of. They're just the NPC in a different dimension. So it's like, be human, realize that there's more to life than just what Twitter trends tell you, and sort of try to find the nuance in life. I think that's where the beauty, the color, and the interesting stuff happens.
Yeah, and I think, you know, maybe just to, you know, what I was finding myself thinking about while reading your book is be okay with disagreeing with people, and you know, try to be comfortable in the space where you're just hearing somebody else's ideas, even if they might not necessarily entirely align with yours. And yeah, you know, the act of that alone is a positive attribute of that we should be celebrating, rather than encouraging this homogenous monothink.
Absolutely, yeah. We can't all agree, and that's the whole point of culture. Like, you know, the WEF wants us all just to agree and do the same thing. Congratulations. Like, the whole point is that we're supposed to argue and disagree and have different needs, wants, desires, etc. And it's perfectly normal. And we don't all have to be friends. You know, we can have I don't know if you've got this version of the draft, or if it's, I'm pretty sure it's in a later draft. I sort of talk about the thing, like the reason I wrote about virtues and not beliefs is that virtues transcend beliefs, religion, and all that sort of stuff. Like, you could be a Muslim, I could be a Christian, someone else can be, you know, atheist, whatever, it doesn't matter. But we can all agree that virtues, things like courage and honesty, integrity, all this sort of stuff matter. And we can still respect each other because these virtues transcend. We can have our own beliefs. You know, I'm not here to convert you to Christianity or anything like that, but I can respect you if you live by these kind of virtues, which seem to me, at least from the study that I've done, they seem to apply across all of these beliefs, all of these religions, all of these great cultures. And if we can, at the very least, form alliances, even though we might disagree with each other on other shit, if we can form alliances on that sort of stuff, I think we have an opportunity to defeat the kind of the world in which those sorts of anti-virtues exist, like lying, cheating, you know, stealing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, which is the kind of framework that we live in. So that's sort of what I hope the book will accomplish, maybe. Let's see. Or maybe it'll just piss everyone off. In which case, whatever.
I would guess it's probably going to be both, and that's probably a good thing.
Probably.
Yeah, well, congratulations, and thank you again for coming on. And if you're listening and you made it all the way to the end of the show, I want to thank you for tuning in again. Your attention is a currency, and I sure hope you enjoyed this conversation and hopefully learned something about Bitcoin. And I hope to see you again next week. That's all for now. Thanks for listening to this episode of The Block Reward. We're trying to do something different here, creating accessible conversations meant for people who aren't obsessed with Bitcoin. If you found this episode informative and engaging, hit that subscribe button to make sure you stay updated with future episodes. Your feedback matters. We'd greatly appreciate it if you could take a moment to share your reviews and help us with our goal of creating Bitcoin content that is simple and easy to understand. Bitcoin has an important role to play in the future of finance. It will change the way we save, spend, and invest. Discover why Bitcoin offers a game-changing opportunity for forward-thinking employers by visiting blockrewards.ca. Block Rewards' mission is helping Canadian employers implement strategies for integrating Bitcoin into compensation and benefits, supercharge your recruitment and retention strategies, and help your team members plan for the rising cost of living by rewarding their work with the hardest money ever invented. Special thanks to our top sponsor, Paramount Employee Benefits Consulting, Canada's only Bitcoin-forward benefits and pension advisory. For more information, find them at paramountbenefits.ca. Big shout out to Podigy, our production team that makes all this possible, and VMX Escape for producing our music. Bitcoin is an expansive and dense topic many people walk away from early. To Bitcoin enthusiasts looking for that podcast they can share with friends, family, and colleagues, one they'll actually listen to, we hope that is us. The content of these conversations is meant to be provided for information purposes only. Nothing here is investment advice. Bitcoin is a big topic. Be sure to do your own research before making any personal financial decisions. Thanks for listening.